Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. August 29th, 2013. And a few topics tonight. I'll be prepping you for the Mars Comet Ison flyby, which will be coming up here around mid-September, beginning then. The actual flyby date is October 1st, as predicted by NASA. I will also be talking about the conditions of crops in the country. That's a very interesting topic. Due to this weather we're having, August begins what they call the aurora season. We have seasons for hurricanes, we have the tornado seasons, or times when there are more tornadoes than others, but August begins the aurora season. Now, why would August begin the aurora season? And by the way, we're at the end of August, and there really has not been much in terms of auroras in the north or the south. The reason August is the aurora month is because we are in the August return current sheet of the sun. And that's something I discovered. It was part of the electrical circuit of the sun. The part of my theoretical work shows that there is an excess current of protons in the solar wind, which creates the overall solar system capacitor, which comets discharge, our own Earth discharges it, all the planets, everything, all their moons, all of the small objects down to dust grain discharge this solar capacitor. I was in a meeting, American Geophysical Union meeting one time, and was talking to some scientists, and they had put some barium particles, not dust, but barium particles, little fine particles, out in outer space, out of a spacecraft, and then watched them. They developed electron clouds to the sunward side, and they developed little teeny tails to the non-sunward sides. So they became little comets. And these scientists had no clue what was going on. Why would barium out in the middle of outer space create little comets around them? But, of course, they had no clue what they were looking at. They just explained the data. And I'm like, yeah, that's what they do. That's what all things do. That's what the big objects do, but that's what the little objects do. But in this overall solar system electrical circuit, the sun cannot simply keep pumping out protons, an excess of protons, forever. At some point, there has to be a return to cause an electric circuit. And because if you continue to deplete the sun of positive charge, it would get to the point where it couldn't do it anymore. So there has to be a return current. There might be more than one, but what I discovered is the peak of the hurricane season is in August. The aurora season is in August. The peak of the tornado season is in August, although there's somewhat of a blip in February, but the peak of the tornado season is in August. So what is it about this month of August that's so special? And at any rate, what I discovered is that there had to be a return current sheet, and by observing the solar wind during this time, clearly something else was going on. So I put two and two together, probably about lots of twos and twos, and discovered that the return current sheet approximately is where we are in the month of August, where Earth is moving in its orbit. So that means the solar wind is acting very differently. But that's what drives our weather system. That means that there is an electric current of electrons passing the other way. Currents are not just unisided, so to speak. And so there's a current of electrons that's naturally passing from the sun outwards in that zone. And Earth is caught in the middle of this kind of crossfire of charged particles, protons moving back inwards and electrons moving outwards. So at any rate, right now, but it's somewhat funny to see. Well, let me first preface this by saying that this year, which is supposedly the maximum of our current solar cycle, this year is extremely weak. There's really not a lot going on. We have a minor coronal hole in the sun. There's some solar wind pouring out of. But basically, we don't have real strong solar conditions, especially for a solar maximum. But for some reason, spaceweather.com continues to exaggerate, in this case, auroral conditions. Where people observe auroras. And so to try and stress this, and like I said, we're already at the end of August and we haven't had any auroras to speak of. So they come out, spaceweather.com comes out and says, look at these tremendous auroras. And then you look at where it is, well, it's in northern Sweden. They have them there all the time. There is a donut-shaped ring around the North Pole, which kind of precesses and moves and amplifies during the day and night, continually, 24 hours a day, all the time, 365 days a year. So for someone to report auroras in northern Sweden is not a big deal. They were a little bit heavier than normal, but not really a big deal. So that's not what you would report. If you were going to report a big whopping beginning of the aurora season, you would report something that people in Chicago saw it with the bright street lights. That would be something to report about. Or something in Kansas or even North Dakota where they see auroras continually. North Dakota is far enough north where, and it's dark enough, there's enough dark sky that if you look north, you can actually see auroras on many nights of the year, but far, far to the distant north. Remember that auroras are very high up in the atmosphere. So the if you look north, you can just see a tinge of them. So the aurora season has begun. It's actually been underway for about a month, really. And it is extremely weak. Along with this solar maximum, we are having a tremendous drought. The drought is extensive. There are parts of the country that have received some rain, but essentially we are in a major drought. We are having another crop failure this year, and I don't know what the actual percentage is of soybeans and corn, and those are kind of the staples that you go by in the United States. Soybeans and corn will definitely be down this year. But GMO corn, if it is watered, will do fabulous. And so in driving through the corn states and looking at soybeans, it's very interesting to see. You'll see some fields that are just devastated, absolutely devastated. And a lot of them are already plowed under, but that's a very small portion of the story. People, the farmers who can water their fields and who were able to water at those critical times when the corn was starting to grow, when the husks were just beginning to form seeds, and when what they call canopy is when the leaves of the corn literally cover the ground. You cannot see through it. It's impermeable to light. And so all of the light is blocked up above, and it protects the ground, and the ground can then retain moisture. So at that point, the corn is off and running, and it's going to be pretty hard to create a drought that will affect the corn, because at that point it's growing. It still needs rain, but at that point it's still tapping into groundwater and has its roots deep enough where it's probably going to survive. Soybeans are not that big. They do not form really a canopy, and are a little bit more susceptible to drought and need better watering. But the bottom line is a lot of corn and a lot of soybeans are succeeding this year. But what kind of corn and soybeans are we talking about? We're talking about GMO. genetically modified corn and soybeans. And so these are designed to grow on ammonia fertilizers. And when they grow, they look big, they look pretty, but there's no food value. Studies have been shown that the GMO-produced corn, when it is grown on the majority of the United States soil, has been depleted of any nutrients for a long time because they just grow corn year after year after year, and they use ammonia fertilizers. It grows a big, beautiful plant, but there's no food value because all the minerals have been depleted from the soil. So at any rate, but I just want to do a little side note here on Monsanto. The Monsanto stock has been dropping. Interestingly enough, there are quite a few high-up executives in Monsanto that have been dumping stock. Gee, well, that doesn't happen when they're expecting the stock to go up in value. The executives dump because they see their little gravy train going south. So some interesting activity in Monsanto, and then the popular investment sentiment in Monsanto is that there are some problems. Monsanto is not succeeding worldwide. Their bully boy tactics in courts around the world has succeeded just because they can pay off the judges, pay off the politicians, and move within those foreign markets. But the bottom line is most foreign countries now have banned GMO food, which means Poland actually plowed under a year ago, created a law and plowed under all GMO food, including corn, and they plowed under a tremendous amount, and they said, no more, we don't want any of this, and they banned it from their borders. Which is the opposite of what Australia has done. Australia will not let anything in unless it's GMO. So it depends on where you are and who's operating the government, who's able to manipulate the agricultural department in the country. But Monsanto stock dropping, Monsanto executives dumping stock, interesting developments. But the United States, the breadbasket of the world, basically, is fixated on GMO. And, of course, our governors, and this started basically when I was a kid. They started the current agricultural practices of cutting down all of the windrows. The windrows are trees, which were by law required after the 1930s Dust Bowl. And if it were not for modern agricultural techniques, we would be having another Dust Bowl in the last couple of years. They did have it down in Oklahoma, Texas, places like that, where it just didn't rain. And it's still, they're still in a long-term drought in those places. Anyway, the bottom line is GMO corn, soybeans, which are the staple of the United States agricultural industry, are very tenuous products, very tenuous, because if they fail in a given year, and they will, there will be years in which they simply, for example, the Ogallala Reservoir is being pumped dry, the underwater reserves, if they go low, we could have a major crop failure, and then that would cause meat prices, for example, to soar. I have seen myself prices for $20 a pound for meat in grocery stores, and I'm like, this is insane. Who buys this stuff? $20 a pound for beef, and I don't buy it. It's like, no, time to be totally vegetarian. But there's something, too, I'll just mention that a wise medical doctor told me one time. He said, as far as dieting, people want to change their diet. People want to change how they eat and lose weight, etc. What the guy said is, you have to eat what your ancestors ate. If you're from Ireland, that means fish and potatoes with some meat. If you're from depending on what your ancestors ate, that's what you should be eating. If you're an American native American from the American Southwest, a high fructose sugar diet is not good for you because your ancestors didn't have that and your body's going to go crazy and you're going to have diabetes. So the standard American diet is horrible for indigenous descendants of the American Southwest or most of the indigenous populations of the United States. There are places in the world where they have an extremely high sugar diet. For example, a lot of there are islands in the Caribbean, in the Pacific, South Pacific, where the natives originally had extremely high sugar diets because that was the available staple food, sugar and sugar sources, coconuts, sugar from coconuts, and a diet like that. And that's what their ancestors ate. So that, oddly enough, would be the best diet for the descendants of those people. So you should eat what your ancestors ate. That's the best thing because your body is tuned to that. You're so in a sense, evolved with that. But nobody is has evolved, so to speak, in terms of the food they should eat with GMO. It's been reported that GMO corn has been now tested to cause cancer in laboratory rats. So this is interesting. Like I say, Monsanto stock going down, the executives dumping stock. Okay, well, enough of that. But the drought this year is real. Amazingly, there will be a relatively decent crop harvest, but GMO crop harvest. Put a big qualification, a giant grain of salt with that one. 2 weeks ago, on Tuesday, a comet came near the sun and actually hit the sun. Before it did, it caused a spark. It discharged the local solar capacitor, caused a huge CME, and within about 3 days, that CME was impacting Earth and going past. And of course, it caused a bit of minor aurora activity. It wasn't the biggest burst in the solar system history, but it was significant. And of course, NASA bent over backwards to deny that had anything to do with, that the comet had anything to do with the CME for the 100th time. Oh, just coincidence, not related. Or their favorite one is the CME occurred before the comet hit, as if a little ice ball were going to hit the sun and cause anything. Although they now have some clown that's published a paper saying that would be the case. Little ice balls can hit the sun and cause a CME, according to one clown. But they're covering themselves on all bases. But the point is, about a week later, after the initial CME left the sun, okay, let's get the timing straight here, just so you understand. The CME, the solar blast, leaves the sun on a Tuesday. I think it was the 23rd of August. I don't have my calendar with me, but at any rate, that date sticks in my mind. Anyway, it was a Tuesday because I did my show on Thursday night and talked about it and talked about the CME hitting Earth probably in the next day. Okay, by the next Tuesday, there was a major series of storms in the United States, and these were totally unpredicted. And what was going on, the Earth was reacting to the CME passing. The Earth was reacting, discharging the solar capacitor, which was very much enhanced by that CME. Okay, so here's my point. The National Weather Service was totally unprepared. They had predicted beautiful sunny weather for the United States. They did not predict in any place severe weather or even a hint of severe weather. So when the storm system started to develop, they simply reported, there's tornadoes, and they put out the emergency warnings. I saw them myself on the internet and on television. Okay, emergency warnings, there are tornadoes here, there's severe weather over there. but they did what I call weather reporting. There was no prediction involved. They had no clue that these things were coming. So in spite of the fact that they jump up and down and say space weather, they have no clue because their computer models, like I said in my book, I think it was the Atlantis to Tesla book, and a number of other places, which this was derived from a web page I had in the 1990s, the phrase I developed was, you cannot predict the weather if you don't know what causes the weather. So if in your computer models, Mr. National Weather Service man or woman, if in your computer models you do not include the factors that cause weather, which is the electrical conditions in the solar system, then you cannot predict the weather. You can extrapolate and kind of mildly predict the weather in a couple days based on past scenarios. But if all of a sudden another factor comes in, like a solar flare, and causes Earth weather, then and that those factors are not in your computer model, then your predictions will be based on basically false or partial information. And that's exactly what happened this past week. The National Weather Service and their reporting network, which goes all the way down to your local radio station or television station, etc., have no clue. So they do weather reporting. I just want to mention that this month of August and prior to August, starting a couple months ago, there have been just a rash of false Planet X reportings. We were all supposed to die in August. Well, it didn't happen again. One woman, what was her name? I don't even want to mention it if I did remember it. Crazy lady breaks out from NASA, says that Planet X is supposed to hit Earth on August 19th, and of course it never does. Obviously a planted misinformation program. I was asked on the Joyce Riley show to comment on that, and I said, hey, lady's a flake, but understand where this is coming from and why. Why would NASA, first of all, if this woman were real, if she worked for NASA, which apparently she did, she had credentials, she worked for Lockheed Martin, a bunch of the aerospace corporations, she worked for NASA, and, why would she come out and say that Planet X was coming and was going to hit Earth on the 19th? It was pushing a big red cloud, and it was going to affect the atmosphere of Mars. Remember that? Well, no more from her. I haven't heard a peep out of her or anything related to it. It just kind of dropped off the map. But why would NASA allow that when they have gag orders on these scientists? And absolutely, if she ever walked in the door to any of those corporations she has worked for, they would have her under strict, absolutely strict gag orders, called a non-disclosure agreement. That's the nice name. Basically a gag order. She can't just walk out and start chatting to the press. They'd have her off the market so fast it'd make your head spin. So the fact that that went on for months tells you that NASA promoted it. They provided her the pictures to show the public. Why would NASA do that? Obviously they want to discredit their own people from making public statements. And then in the future, if anybody ever walked out and said, we know about Planet X, they would just point to this lady and say, oh, that's just another one of those wackos, like the Patty Broussard, that was her name. So if you ever hear somebody referring to NASA wackos, Patty Broussard, that's to discredit in the future any NASA employee that would try and make a break and try and tell you about Planet X if they have private information. You see? Well-planted disinformation piece. That's what it's all about, and it's sitting there. It hasn't gone away. It'll resurface someday in that form. Mark my words. There are cases where my name has been used, and there's some nutcases out there that send information out and use my name. I don't have people that represent me. I don't have people that say, oh, Jim McCanney said this, and then do mass mailings. No, that's bogus. I've come to determine that there are a number of people out there that are in government mind control programs. And these are just nutcases, nutcases that came out of the woodwork and decided one day that God had spoken to them, and their goal was to tell everybody about Planet X. That was their mission in the designated by God. Okay, so you get these nutcases that are out there. Everything that comes in, Comet Elenin was Planet X. Comet Ison is Planet X. Eight other comets that came in before them were Planet X. Everything is Planet X. Oh, now it's on the other side of the sun. You can't see it, but it's there. NASA is hiding data. All of the garbage that they can imagine. Everything in the kitchen sink. And then some of these people try and put my name on it. So if you've been a victim, and it's not just one or two, and they try and put my name on it, quote or take passages from my radio shows or books or whatever. That isn't me. I have nothing to do with that. But understand that if I went out and tried to chase down all of these little nutcases, first of all, it'd burn up all my time, and they'd create 20 more because they see it's diverting Jim McCanney. So I just have to tell my audience, look, you know, this is what's going on. Be aware of it, be educated, and then realize that these people are in mind control programs with the government. When the government finds these little idiots out there, they love them. Why? Because they work for nothing. If they didn't exist, they would have to create them. And it's just a big free Benny for the government misinformation programs that want to keep the public stupid. Also, it fills the airwaves with garbage. Planet X is this, it's that, it's like everybody's, I was on John Moore's show, some guy calls in and he goes, I'm so sick of this Planet X stuff. And then they criticized me for talking about Planet X. Well, there is a real story about Planet X. And so what? I have to spend my time denouncing nutcases that are putting out false information about Planet X. There is a real story regarding Planet X. In the fact, I've always said there's not one Planet X, there are many. There's no one single Planet X. And this story that was started by some people to say that there was a 3,600-year orbit, that was an estimate back in the 1980s, and that's been carried over and over, and people repeat that. Well, we have a history for 3,600 years, and there was no Planet X. There was the Venus event, which people confuse, where Venus became a comet. It came by Mars, lifted the oceans and atmosphere off of Mars. It had two encounters. This big comet had two encounters with Earth. The ancient Maya called it Quetzalcoatl, and eventually that comet became the planet Venus. That was the Venus event, so if that became Venus, it's not coming back. It's here. It's in the solar system. It became Venus. So it's not going to come back in 3,600 years after that initial event. That's what Velikovsky talks about, but Velikovsky never talks about Planet X. He talks about this giant comet becoming Venus. And as far as I can tell, that's a very good timeline scenario. Prior to that, there's always been big comets. There probably is a bigger one, but we don't have good data on this. So the little minions running around 3,600-year orbit, it's all garbage. There's not a shred of evidence to suggest that there is a Planet X object with a 3,600-year recurring orbit. It's probably much longer. And if there's many of them, how do you tell this one from that one from the one over there? You don't, because we don't have data. We don't have good data on this. And NASA, I'm sure, has good data on a lot of these, probably seeing some of them that are still outbound going out of the solar system. And, of course, that's not something they're going to talk about. That's the Tier 1 science, not the Tier 2 garbage science that the NASA pawns off on you. Okay, so that's just a little educational blip. I like to cover this on my show every now and then, because people have to get educated. But then you have to say to yourself, the real education comes with the following. Why is the government, why is NASA, why do they support all of these little nobodies with mind control programs to run out and give false Planet X information? That's because there is a real story. There is a real story, and they want the public to very stupid regarding this, because it's a control factor. If the public knew about this, they would begin to change their lifestyle. They would begin to demand that we have a real space program where we get people into space, not an astronaut every 10 years. The American public space program is a piece of junk. It's a worthless piece of junk. But behind it, there's a lot of tier one science that you never see or hear about, and that's the real story. Okay. My name has been involved in some asteroid predictions. The world's going to end with asteroids. I don't make predictions. I don't, unless I have real data. If I had real data, I would be posting it on my webpage and I would be presenting it on this program, not sending it out through some second source, idiots, no, it doesn't happen. I only post on my webpage. There's a good one I'll mention too. Some people said, well, they found out about me on YouTube, and so YouTube is good. No, YouTube is the biggest piece of junk on the planet. It's the biggest misinformation source on the planet. And, you know, some people say, well, it references me. Well, you know, if you get to my webpage, that's all I want. Stay on my webpage. Looking on my webpage, listen to the radio shows, read the various postings that I have on my webpage that have accumulated over the years, and read the books, the DVDs. If you get through all of that and then go back and do it a second time, so that you then, once you get the gist of what's going on, do it a second time, you're going to be one very busy person. And so you're not going to have time to sit there and read emails from little nobodies trying to present my information in completely falsified. So anyway, it's an education process. Okay, switching gears. I'm going to talk about Comet Ison here a little bit and what is coming up. We are entering the merry month of September, and this is the month where Comet Ison will start to interact with the planet Mars. And so here's what's happening from the view of the solar system. Mars is moving around in its orbit. It's still quite a ways off of the beeline with the Sun and Comet Ison. It is nowhere near in line with Comet Ison. That alignment will start to catch somewhere in around the mid-September time frame. Mars is going to get around close enough to alignment with Comet Ison to where they might start interacting electrically. That's why I'm giving people that early time frame. It's probably too early for an interaction to happen, but you never know. You never know. NASA has all kinds of instruments around Mars, and they're going to start to tweak them to look around and see if they can see the comet. These instruments were not designed to view comets, but they're hoping to get some kind of data from any of these instruments. And, of course, they have the Hubble, which is not really a NASA instrument. They call it the NASA Hubble Space Telescope, but it's really a military device. And now and then they'll put out a pretty picture to wow the public, like, oh, they're really showing us some wonderful data, but no. The Hubble Space Telescope is up there doing serious military work, and it's not available. That information is simply not available to the public. That's all Tier 1 science, and I've had Tier 1 scientists come out and talk to me. They've asked me questions. They wanted to get redirected. What's going on here? What's causing such and such a thing to happen? And but the that's totally removed from anything the public sees or is ever going to see. But what I'm saying is that the Hubble Space Telescope is very much interested in Comet Ison. Even though, now I should report too, the Comet Ison is turning out to be a much smaller comet than originally predicted. And that's what I said when NASA started early last spring. NASA was saying, this Comet Ison, comet of the century. And then they go, the nucleus is 2 miles wide. I'm going, well, wait a minute. That's little. That's teeny. How is this going to become the comet of the century? Well, the problem is, too, is NASA lies about comet nuclei size. They said the comet Hale-Bopp was 42 kilometers across. That's the official diameter. It was more like 1,000. It was more almost the size of our moon. And it had orbiting companion coming in, something else that NASA lied about, to the public at least. In private meetings, they admitted that there was a companion. But regarding Comet Ison, it's very difficult to say what's going on with this comet because NASA has had so much variability in their reports. But the bottom line is that around October 1st, Comet Ison will pass about 7 million miles up above Comet Mars and then pass down right in front of it between it and the Sun. And that's when Comet Ison will start to pick up some speed. NASA has a group in place and headed by a scientist from Goddard Space Flight Center poised to present a lot of misinformation to the public. And I have to scratch my head every now and then. I go back and forth and I go, I know some of these scientists personally. And they're not bad scientists. They're knowledgeable. Some are physicists that have a good base knowledge of space physics. Can they be really that stupid to think that these are little ice balls and that they're outgassing? And on one hand, I think that they are that stupid. And then on the other hand, I say, well, these guys cannot be that stupid unless they're just being left to wallow in Tier 2 science, and they really are that stupid. Maybe for other reasons they have not been allowed into Tier 1 science, or if they have, they're doing this pretend Tier 2 science, and that's part of their job, is to present false information to the public, like the Dirty Snowball Comet model. At any rate, NASA has begun an observing program, and they want amateurs from all over the world to send them the photos. Actually, this whole thing started back in the 90s. I had a comet viewing program where I had amateurs sending me photos. It was a pair of comets. I had an amateur viewing. I had a subpage. I had an email address that was set up to receive the emails, and it was blocked. The people could not get their photos to me. And then NASA woke up and they said, oh, we should be having the comet pictures sent to us from all the people around the world. So they jumped in and had their own comet viewing session with people sending them the photos. And so now NASA, following suit, they certainly don't want anybody sending anything to me. But you see, all of those photos can be filtered, homogenized, and blended and interpreted before the public ever sees them. And for some reason, they have put a lot of effort into Comet Ison. So there's something going on with Comet Ison that they don't want the public to know about. But the point is, on March 1st, this comet will come very close to Mars. And already, they're predicting let's back up a step. When Comet Ison first came out, I did an orbital analysis, and I said, okay, in the position this comet will be aligned with the planet
if it's big enough, which it was supposed to be big enough,
it would have been aligned with the region of Jupiter's orbit, not Jupiter itself, but the region of Jupiter where there's a lot of sulfur dioxide. And so the point is that, yes, Comet Ison were able to pull in that material and connect electrically with
Mars being obviously bigger gravitationally, Mars could have a serious pollution event. And part of that would be sulfur dioxide, causing a reddening of the Martian atmosphere. So when I did that, along comes the NASA little dupe and says that there is a stream of red particles emanating from Comet Ison, and it's shooting out one direction, and it's going to shoot out the other direction, and part of that will hit Earth on January 14th, one of the dates that I had predicted that Earth could experience this sulfur dioxide influx, but also that Mars would experience this. And that, by the way, that's part of the Patty Brassard misinformation that Planet X was coming in. It was pushing a red cloud in front of it, which is complete goofy science. I've never even heard anything so ridiculous before, but that's what she was saying. And it was already affecting Mars. So you see, they're trying to create a cover story for the people who might listen to me, for why Mars would all of a sudden be turning, having a red condition in its atmosphere. Also auroras. We could see electrical discharges between the comet and Mars. Well, electrons primarily would be the charge carrier in the discharge, and you don't see electrons. But if there are gases and dust in that region, they will illuminate. They will become luminous, giving off light due to the passing electron current, and you could potentially see this in your binoculars. And so what I'm leading up to here is how to observe Comet Ison, and then also I'll be talking about the interaction in upcoming shows. I'll be talking about the interaction of Comet Ison with the planet Mercury, which will be cause another viewing event. And by the way, a listener called in, and I sometimes refer to the event where Mercury could go comet, or Mars could go comet. Well, understand that all of the planets, all of the moons of the planets, all the big objects of the solar system, and all the little objects of the solar system are already acting as comets. All of them are discharging the solar capacitor. It's just that the conditions are very difficult to detect and see, and certainly with the naked eye, they're difficult to see. In the case where Comet Ison is coming right down the backside of little planet Mercury, very close, Mercury could go comet. In other words, it could develop a comet tail, visible comet tail, and if you had the proper equipment, you could see electrical discharges in the form of secondary X-rays on the noseward side of the planet Mercury. And then the electrical discharge that passed way out into outer space, those would be detectable with specialized equipment. But to the average person, a planet going comet, would be simply that you would see the comet tail developing around the planet. And this is something we have not seen, really. I have seen it with the planet Venus. I have seen Venus go comet a number of times in the SOHO cameras. When Venus comes around and starts to become aligned with Earth on the near side of the Sun, it's passing between us and the Sun. I have seen numerous times where Venus goes comet. It's already a comet. It already has a faint comet tail, but it is visually going comet. In other words, it is developing a visual comet tail. And so that's what I'm talking about. And the point is that Mars could develop a comet tail briefly as it interacts with Comet Ison, because Ison is a large discharge of the solar capacitor, and it's connecting with Mars. Mars normally would have a very small discharge, but now it's going to have a big one, so it could potentially go comet. In other words, turn into a comet. Okay, now here's your viewing instructions. Starting around September 15th, go out in the early morning sky, and even though we probably are not going to see anything at that point, the lunar conditions are not perfect, etc. You can start to get acclimated to looking at Mars, finding Mars, etc. So start around September 15th. Go out. You got to get away from city lights. Get out in the countryside where you got a good view of the east. You have to look east. And remember, if the sun comes up, don't look at the sun with your eyes. Don't look at the sun with binoculars or any other optical equipment because you can damage your eyes. But you're going to be up long before the sun gets up. So get up, 4 or 5 in the morning. Get out to your dark spot, eastern horizon visible. A lot of times a lake is a great place. Get on the western side of a lake and look east, and that gives you a really great horizon. The trees on the other side of the lake will be low. Okay, now look for that red planet on the horizon in the east in the morning. That's Mars. Unmistakable. There's nothing else like it. It's a big red dot. Our vantage point, it looks like a star almost, but like a big star, but very red. Okay, Mars is coming up on the eastern horizon. And look up and to the right. That's where Comet Ison will be. If you have good binoculars, and by the way, for people who want to get binoculars, I'll just do a little refresher here. I personally use a very big set of binoculars. They're wonderful for comet viewing. They have a great wide field view, and they really grab the light. So I have 100-centimeter binoculars. They weigh about 15 pounds. I put them on a big tripod, and they're 25 power. Well, that's kind of overkill for the average person. So what does the average person need? First of all, make sure you have fully coated optics. I'll repeat that. Fully coated, C-O-A-T-E-D, coated optics. And you can get binoculars like that sometimes you can find them at Walmart, but make sure it says right on the binoculars, fully coated optics. And not just some of the lenses. You want all the prisms, everything inside coated. That gives you a nice, even field of view. It doesn't cloud the field of view with poorly ground optics with no coating. So for the average person, make sure you get a tripod, a good tripod. And I would say a 7 power would be okay. And maybe a 50 millimeter lenses, something like that would be a real good comet watching, and then a wide field of view. You would like to have a fairly wide field of view, but 10 power, you definitely need a tripod, and it's harder to find things. So in fact, I have a pair of binoculars that are zoom. They go from, I think, 7 to 40 in a zoom, and they're not the greatest, but they can be useful. So I would buy binoculars, probably 7 power, probably a minimum of 40 millimeter lenses. That's the far away lens. And another thing you want to look for is the eyepiece where you put your eyes. Make sure it's not a little dot. You want to make sure that there's a nice big, not quite the size of a penny, a bit smaller, about even half the size of a penny. But if the dot is too small, there, the lens that goes next to your eye, it's extremely difficult to view. So you want a nice big lens there. And so, but there are optical houses that deal with astronomy. I won't give any names on the air, but you can find them on the internet, especially designed for astronomy. And those you should have, because Comet Ison, I doubt, will be naked eye visible at that point. So you will need binoculars to see the comet. Okay, so once again, 4 in the morning you get up. And also look in your local newspaper. It'll probably tell you the Mars, when Mars will rise on the eastern horizon. And I'll get a little bit more specific about that as the date comes near. Okay, so get up at, say, 4, 4.30 in the morning. Get out to your nice, clear spot with an eastern view of the horizon. Set up your tripod. Wait for Mars to come up. Red planet in the eastern sky, just south of east, actually.
and a little bit south of east, and then from Mars, with your monoculars, go up a little bit and up to the upper right. That's where you will find Comet Ison, with the tail pointing somewhat away from Mars. That's the view you will have, and start to get used to that. If there were a major electrical discharge between the comet and Mars, you would be able to see that. But it'd have to be pretty major. But understand that NASA has equipment that will see it in very good detail. They'll have all kinds of instrumentation fixed on Mars, including the instrumentation that would see X-rays, ultraviolet light, and they would be able to observe all of those things that you would not be able to see with your binoculars if Mars goes comet. They also have the equipment on the surface of Mars, and they will be able to see if there's an influx of sulfur dioxide, etc. And once again, that's indicative of what's in the comet tail, what's being drawn in. And from this point also, Comet Ison will be much more of a local comet in terms of its tail material. I'm of the opinion now that I doubt if it's going to extend all the way to the orbit of Jupiter to pull in that sulfur dioxide. It might, but it's very questionable. This is not turning out to be the major barn-storming comet that NASA originally predicted. So, at any rate, that's basic viewing information around mid-September. And then October 1st is when the actual closest encounter will occur. So that's definitely, put that on your calendar, the 27th, 28th, 29th of September. And then into the first few days, October 1st, 2nd, 3rd, that's when also the comet will be on the left side of Mars, on the sunward side, and there might be some very interesting activity at that point. So, at any rate, I'll be talking more about that in the future programs. I should also mention I'll be looking closely, and I'm sure NASA knows that, be looking closely at the data that they're presenting, but they're going to be extremely careful not to let anything out that doesn't have Dirty Snowball, Little Icy Wanderer, and all those other little catchphrases that they permeate every article with regarding comets. You can expect a lot of that. I just want to reiterate that Comet Ison is not predicted in my just looking at the orbit and where it will be relative to Earth. I do not see Comet Ison as being any threat of any kind to Earth or Earthlings. In early January, we will get a view of Comet Ison as it passes over our North Pole and out of the solar system. We will have a view of Comet Ison, and shortly thereafter, it will be... around mid-January, it'll be between us and Jupiter. We'll have a Jupiter, comet, Earth, new moon, and Venus alignment, which is incredible. That is an amazing, amazing alignment. So we could have some January hurricane activity. We could potentially see some sulfur dioxide coming into Earth's upper atmosphere. And remember, NASA already has their cover stories in place. Because of my predictions, my original predictions, they have developed cover stories for every one of these scenarios in case they happen, in case there are auroras. Why would a little dirty snowball out millions and millions of miles away, out beyond us, cause auroras? Or a lot of the conditions are red. Red auroras are very special auroras. Why would this comet cause that? Well, they already have all their little cover stories in place. And so if these things happen, they're poised to, through spaceweather.com or through space.com, send out these little misinformation pieces. It sure shows that they're extremely intent on misinforming the public. I guess that's the biggest point. Extremely intent. The NASA Visible Tier 2 Science, extremely intent on misinforming the public. Just at the end here, I want to comment some observations. People are in much greater numbers becoming water independent. Now, what is water independent? Somebody receives their boxes in the mail or shipping, UPS, whatever, and they open them up. They have a beautiful stainless steel or high-density polyethylene water filter casing. They open up another box. It has their set of 2 or 4 or 10 water filter elements. They open up another box. There's the pre-filter with the big canister that goes on your regular gravity water filter to pre-filter water to be prepared in case of a major pollution event or a nuclear fallout event. A lot of people use the pre-filter on my web, sold on my webpage, that pre-filters water. They use them every day because of the amount of minerals, etc., in their water, or they have sludgy water, high sulfur content, all kinds of cases, and they use that pre-filter before the water goes into their filter. A lot of people use the filter, pre-filter, on a daily basis. More and more people are ordering the modular filtration and storage system, up to 20 gallons or more. If you want, you can buy more of the storage containers, but a way that you can store up to 20 gallons of clean water in sealed, airtight sealed containers. No place else on the internet or any place are you going to find any product like that. So also I want to mention my book Comets was released last spring. It's still available on the webpage, and only available in ebook format. Also the latest book, Water, and a very important book, also only available in e-format on the webpage. And the new book, Water, available. In fact, the best deal is if you buy all the books. I think it's $69. You get the water book free, and all of the books includes the e-books, which includes the Comets book. So all of my books are in e-format. They're also available. A lot of people still buying the hardcover. They like the hardcover format of the books, plus the DVDs. There's a lot of interest lately in the 2-CD set. The History of Ancient Celestial Disasters, The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters. 18 hours of lectures of mine dealing with ancient celestial disasters, including Planet X topics. So it's really a powerful, huge amount of information that is necessary for people to understand what's going on. And I'm out of time. I'll talk to you next week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.